Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Never Ride a Roller Coaster Upside Down, The Ups, Downs, and Reinvention of an Entrepreneur by Jeff Smullyan. Narrated by Jeff Smullyan. Forward. If you were ever under the impression that being an entrepreneur is an easy, one-way bet to endless reward, Jeff Smullyan's long career in broadcasting, radio, and whatever else he found along the way will quickly disabuse you of that notion. Smullyan makes it no secret, being an entrepreneur is hard, particularly if the chosen area of focus is an industry of endless challenge that requires constant reinvention, all while the fickle capital markets constantly threaten to shut you down. This book is as much textbook as memoir, offering countless lessons on the way to build a career in business. You want to learn what it feels like to start a radio station, build a TV station business, run a radio empire, start the first all-sports radio station, and own a Major League Baseball team? Smullyan has the answer, and he teaches it in the most effective way, by sharing his many mistakes along the way. The journey of Jeff's life and business proves that nice guys don't always finish last, but they sure don't always finish first. I've known Jeff for long enough to remember when his company, Emmis, was significant enough to merit regular mention on CNBC. Those days are long gone, but there was so much I had forgotten or never known about the radio business and how Smullyan always managed to fight on despite the obstacles to success. His retelling of both the halcyon days of radio and the near-death experience brought on by a suddenly stingy capital market was particularly insightful for someone who has covered markets for decades. As his story unspools, you'll meet a wonderful cast of characters, along with some well-known names from broadcasting. Who do you think gave David Letterman his start? But it's the intricacies of dealing with the daily challenges of trying to build a company that will stay with you. That and the fact that Smullyan is funny, or at least his many stories are funny. His humor draws you in so that you find yourself rooting for him to succeed, or at least not fail too badly. Should he have sold Emmis when he had the chance years ago? Probably. Should he have tried to hang on to the Seattle Mariners with losses mounting and a city turned against him? Possibly. And did he really need to sell WFAN, one of the most successful and groundbreaking stations of all time? I will leave that for the reader to decide. One thing not in question is Smullyan's love for radio. It lives on, as does something else he shares with those who have faced setbacks in business but ultimately persevere. He is relentless, and I mean that in the best possible way. David Faber. Prologue. I originally wanted to call this book, What Have We Learned? After the first question I invariably ask when I start meeting with my managers. The phrase summarizes my desire to learn what others are thinking, and it's the interaction that best explains how members of my team deal with each other. However, as I started recounting the stories of my life and career, I realized that my life is best described as a long, strange roller coaster ride. Given the sometimes tumultuous turns I have taken, the title, Never Ride a Roller Coaster Upside Down, is far more appropriate. I'm a fanatical believer in lifelong learning. In fact, one of my favorite movie scenes is from 3 Days of the Condor, a classic spy film from the 1970s. Robert Redford is a researcher for the CIA, and he returns from lunch to find his entire section has been murdered. Later, he realizes he was the target of the attack. Incredulously, he asks, why would they target me? I'm just a reader. I thought about that line thousands of times because at heart, that's what I am, just a reader. And I found much of my success has come from absorbing information. My 3 children put it best. Dad is a lesson guy. I'm aware that over the years, Carrie, Brad, and now Sam have been driven to distraction by my constantly asking, what have we learned from this? However, as a proud father, I can tell you that all 3 have taken many of those lessons to heart, and Carrie and Brad have become very kind, compassionate, and inquisitive adults, and Sam is on her way. I'm certain all 3 of them will leave this world a better place than they found it. Moreover, my managers will quickly add that Jeff is also a story guy. Some of the stories are funny, some provide valuable insights, some are straight out bizarre, and many are just remembrances of an old guy who has been amused by the many strange events of his life. Rest assured, all of them are true. I've tried to curate the stories of this book so they will give you a behind-the-scenes view not only of my company, but of the world of media and sports and the fascinating characters you find around every corner. The lessons that arise from these stories are the same ones I have learned, or at least tried to, over a 50-year career. And since I'm an entrepreneur, this book will provide the unvarnished truth about what that really means. This isn't a book about inventing a revolutionary product that changes the world, or a story about scaling the mountaintops of commerce and emerging unscathed. Instead, it's about what happens in some fascinating businesses when things go spectacularly right, and just as often when they go painfully wrong. Anyone who wants to be an entrepreneur needs to understand that to succeed, you absolutely have to know how to handle failure, and this book will provide lots of examples of both. Never Ride a Roller Coaster Upside Down is not exclusively about business, because life is, or should be, so much more. To that end, this book will provide a number of lessons that are critical to understanding how to navigate the roller coaster ride that will be your life. Some of these may be ones you've heard of before, while others may be surprising. Regardless, all should be relevant to anyone who wants to captain their own ship. This book also provides insights into the economics of media and sports, to show you another intriguing look behind the scenes of these industries that have such a foothold in our lives. Through a host of interesting stories told in plain terms we can all understand, you will peel back the curtain on how media and sports really work. Some of those insights will probably surprise you, and some should amuse you as well. Writing this book has been one of the most cathartic, enjoyable experiences I've ever had. I hope you will have fun listening to it and come away with an understanding that will help you in all of your endeavors. Chapter 1. Do What You Love. Over the past 50 years, I've had an immensely rewarding, albeit sometimes bizarre, career in media, sports, entertainment, and even a slice of government. Most people know me because I invented radio's all-sports format with the launch of WFAN New York. Others have heard of me because of my controversial tenure as owner of the Seattle Mariners baseball team. For years, I've told friends that I had to be an entrepreneur because I'm not capable of being hired in a free society. My entrepreneurial roots run deep. I come from a family that was part of the first wave of Jewish immigrants in the 1880s and 1890s, most escaping from the pogroms in Russia and Ukraine. My father's father came through Ellis Island and ultimately moved west to Indiana, where he worked for himself. Doing what? I'll give you a tip that will serve you well at cocktail parties. When you meet someone who is Jewish in the Midwest, ask if their family was in scrap or dry goods. They will be amazed at your perceptive skills. It's a trick question. Every Jew in the Midwest was in scrap or dry goods. My father's father was a peddler, selling his wares in several small towns in Indiana until he settled in Indianapolis, where he started a poultry business that operated successfully for many years. My mother's father, who had also landed in Indiana, was a classic entrepreneur. In 1912, he started one of the first, if not the first, automobile finance companies in the United States. The business was wildly successful all through the next three decades, and he prospered even as the country was ravaged by the Depression. After my dad returned from active duty during World War II, both his father and his father-in-law wanted him to join their respective businesses. My mother lobbied hard, and my dad agreed to join her father's company, Indiana Finance. While it had enjoyed a terrific niche market before World War II, Indiana Finance gradually declined as banks realized that automobiles were valuable collateral. By 1960, when my grandfather died, the business was still profitable, but on a much smaller scale. My dad and my uncle, seeing little future in Indiana Finance, branched out into Howard Johnson's motels and a sizable apartment complex. For the past 11 years, I've had the pleasure of driving my younger daughter, Sammy, to school every morning. We talk about everything, and my lessons bubble up naturally from the stories of my life. One time, we were discussing how to have a successful career, and I surprised her by telling her she had to be prepared to fail. I know when you're starting out, you think success is going to be a straight line to the top, but setbacks are inevitable. Life is really a roller coaster ride of ups, downs, dips, and wild turns. The key to staying on the roller coaster is to enjoy the ride, and for that, you need to find something you love doing. Sammy gave me a skeptical look. She had heard that her great-grandparents weren't in love with their successful businesses. I countered that they loved the family life their work afforded, but that's not the same as loving your career. To press my point, I brought up the adage, if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life. Sammy liked that, but she wondered how I knew so early what my lifelong passion was going to be. And that led to telling her how I began my career. As a young child, I grew up with a passion for radio. It's hard to describe how different radio was in the 1950s and 1960s compared to the medium we know today. With the advent of television, broad-based programming declined, and radio became a niche medium. Radio stations could no longer rely on national programs like The Jack Benny Show or Fibber McGee and Molly to survive. Those series had made the transition to television. As a result, radio was pronounced dead in the early 50s, but it reinvented itself by narrowing its programming into various formats: country music, adult hits, easy listening, rhythm and blues, and the most successful format, Top 40. Between the rise of transistors and the explosion of the baby boom, it seemed that every preteen and teenager carried around a transistor radio, the first pocket-sized receiver available. With transistors, inefficient vacuum tubes could be reduced to a series of tiny wires, and thus everyone could listen to their favorite stations wherever they went. Transistor radios became ubiquitous, and with them, the stations that defined the lives of nearly every young American. In the late 50s, Top 40 radio began to skyrocket, fueled by iconic artists like Elvis Presley. I'm sure there were kids who were immune to Top 40 radio, but I never met any of them. Listening to the latest hits, either on stations in Indianapolis or from Chicago or Detroit, provided the entertainment for my generation. In addition, as a baseball fan, I could hear my favorite team, the San Francisco Giants, merely by listening to the games on radio stations from other National League cities. Through clear channel stations, strong signals that carried across the United States, I could listen to my beloved Giants when they played in Chicago, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, St. Louis, and New York. This was long before the wall-to-wall coverage on cable TV, actually long before cable TV. And radio was the only way to consume most sports in the late 50s and early 60s. Radio was our escape, listening to the hits in our rooms at night, and even listening to late-night ball games with our transistor radios under our pillows, hidden from parental curfews. It's amazing how many friends in my industry had the same experiences, turning down the radio so our parents thought we were doing our homework and pretending we were asleep while being mesmerized by the late innings of a baseball game transmitted from the comfort of our pillows. Nearly every city had at least one Top 40 station. In Indianapolis, that was WIFE. Don Burden, a classic entrepreneur from Omaha, bought a failing station at 1310 on the AM dial and launched a radio revolution in the city. With ubiquitous billboards, contests, bumper stickers, and a slick presentation, he took the city by storm. It was impossible to find a teenager who didn't listen to WIFE night and day. In addition, the nonstop contest and promotion pulled a sizable number of adults into the fold. Within 6 months, WIFE turned its ratings around, taking an unprecedented 35% of all listeners and sending longtime market leader WIBC spiraling downward. The two stations developed an intense rivalry that led to Burden many years later losing the licenses for all his stations, Indianapolis, Omaha, and Portland, for violating Federal Communications Commission FCC rules prohibiting free airtime to U.S. senators. Many believe that Burden's downfall was hastened because WIBC was owned by the politically connected Richard Fairbanks, a descendant of U.S. Vice President Charles Warren Fairbanks, who delighted in using his influence to put pressure on Burden. And Burden didn't make matters simple for himself either, with his legendary hubris making him an easy target for the FCC. My favorite Burden story is about one night when he was quite inebriated. He called into the request line at WIFE and demanded that disc jockey Scott Wheeler, then on the air, play the 1912 hit My Melancholy Baby. Scott naively responded, "Sir, we don't play Melancholy Baby. It's not on our playlist." To which Burden replied, "You stupid SOB, I'm Don Burden. I own this station, and it's on the playlist now." Wisely, Scott dug up My Melancholy Baby and interrupted a few Beatles songs to play it. There were other top 40 stations all over America, and in every city, teenagers were addicted to their favorites. When I started college in 1965 in Los Angeles, KHJ had just made its debut and completely took the city by storm. With its tight playlist, catchy jingles, vivid imaging, and brilliant disc jockeys, KHJ sped to the top of Los Angeles ratings and stayed there for many years. KHJ's two stars were Robert W. Morgan, who did mornings, and the real Don Steele, who did afternoons. Morgan's impact was so great that Morgan and the Morgan, Morgan is German for morning, spawned imitators from coast to coast. In radio, if something works spectacularly well in one city, it is guaranteed to be copied everywhere very quickly. In Indianapolis, we had Roger W. Morgan. Detroit had Chuck Morgan, and on and on. None had Robert W.'s wit, but at least they could copy the name. Like just about everyone in Los Angeles, I was hooked on KHJ and found Morgan to be as talented as anyone I had ever heard on the air. In those days, it was impossible to roll down your windows at a stoplight and not hear KHJ coming from multiple cars. The movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, used KHJ as a soundtrack to inform the audience that the film was set in the lead-up to the 1969 Manson murders. Because the Top 40 format required the personalities to fit their humor into segments of less than a minute, Morgan's quick wit was perfect for the station. Ironically, years later, I hired an aging Robert W. Morgan for our first station in Los Angeles. While the keen wit was still there, too many years of too much alcohol had turned his natural acerbity into an anger that generated a hostile workplace. I spent many hours on the phone with his agent, resolving the challenges Robert W. presented to his fellow employees. Near the end of the KHJ era, NBC was trying to save its weekend show, Monitor. Monitor had been a relic of earlier days in radio, a broadly based entertainment program that had trouble staying relevant in a now more segmented industry. To update the show, NBC decided to hire the two most talented disc jockeys in America, Morgan and Don Imus, and put them together to see if they could save it. The effort ultimately failed, but Morgan and Imus became best friends. The story I'm about to relate may be apocryphal, but it has to be the most retold story in the history of American radio. Supposedly, Imus and Morgan had been out carousing in Hollywood all night long, and at 5 a.m., they were both standing at an intersection in a drunken stupor when a little old lady drove up and asked for directions to Sunset and Vine. One of the two supposedly unzipped his pants, pulled out his penis, and pointed to one of the veins and said, "This is Sunset. Go down three blocks." And then, pointing to the other vein, added, "This is Vine. That will get you there." For a variety of reasons, there are no more stories like that in American radio today. Everything about the radio business mesmerized me. Unlike television, in which you were largely a captive of your network and beholden to program whatever is sent down the line, radio is a complete blank slate. You picked the format and the talent, devised the marketing, and summoned all of your creativity to build a business. For someone with entrepreneurial genes, a radio station was the perfect place to launch a career. At an early age, I knew it was what I wanted to do. When I finished my senior year of college, before starting law school, I decided to look for a summer job in radio. And one of my fraternity brothers had a distant cousin at KABC, George Green, then the station's sales manager. George agreed to speak with me as a courtesy, but he told me up front, for the meeting, he didn't have any jobs. As we talked for about 30 minutes, he commented, "How do you know all this stuff about the industry?" I told him I read Broadcasting Magazine every week cover to cover, and that I also studied the industry in my spare time. Radio was my hobby. He hired me on the spot, launching my radio career. I had always intended to pursue a graduate degree. My first inclination was to get a master's in telecommunications, and I targeted Stanford's program. However, after seeking advice from several people, including my dad, the consensus was, if you want to be an entrepreneur, get a law degree. When you get out of school, you'll have the instant credibility a master's degree won't give you. So I chose law school at USC. Looking back, I'm fascinated that not one person suggested an MBA. Today, the advice would be 100% to get an MBA or a joint JD-MBA degree. But back then, most people thought little of a graduate degree in business. It's amazing how much the world has changed. At USC, I earned my degree writing my law review article on the FCC's Clear Channel Doctrine and was ready to tackle the world. I've been a member of the Indiana State Bar Association for nearly 50 years, but have been on inactive status for most of that time. I've joked that if I actually decided to practice law, I would be disbarred within the first week. My attorneys constantly tease me that I don't even have the patience to listen to most of their legal analysis, let alone do the analysis myself. After law school, I joined forces with a few friends, and for nearly a year, we chased radio deals, always coming up empty. Then my dad called with an offer. He and my mom wanted me to come home to Indiana, and he had a cousin with a small radio station in Indianapolis that happened to be failing. My dad said he would invest in the station if I would agree to come home. That way I could run the station for a while until I found other, more promising radio deals and could start my own company. Not wanting to leave California, I resisted his entreaties for a number of months. But I finally realized that this was the right way to start and headed home. For the first few months after my return, I wondered what in the world possessed me to come home to Indiana. As time went on, however, I began to fall in love with all the exciting developments that were taking place in Indianapolis. The city of my youth, which had given rise to the John Birch Society and other reactionary elements, was a thing of the past, replaced by a tolerant, imaginative community that was willing to try different approaches to compete in a global marketplace of ideas and talent. For many, many years, as my company's holdings grew, friends always asked why I stayed in Indiana when we owned stations in New York, Los Angeles, and other seemingly more desirable locales. I explained that Indianapolis was a growing, dynamic city, and it was fun to be part of a community that embraced change so completely. When I came back, I decided to switch the station, WNIR, from a country format to WNTS, which stood for News, Talk, and Sports. Perhaps the best way to describe running WNTS was Warren Buffett's adage about the impossible project. To paraphrase, Buffett said, "Show me an impossible project and give me good people working on it. And 3 years later, you'll find a project that is still impossible and worn out good people." I'm not sure how good my team and I were, but trying to make a daytime-only station work at 1590 on the AM dial, where signal reception is much worse than on the other end of the dial, e.g. 540, did turn out to be an impossible project. I've seen a few businesses like this in my career, and I've developed my own adage. If you need to kick a 70-yard field goal into the wind to win the game, you probably shouldn't be on the field. WNTS was facing insurmountable odds, but it was a remarkably fun, if challenging, station to run. I'll always look back on WNTS as one of the great lessons of my life. Throughout this book, you'll hear my old saying, you do your best work in the most difficult situations, and that's what we did at WNTS. We marketed WNTS as the scrappy underdog, going up against the city's behemoth, WIBC, which in the post-WIFE era had reasserted itself as Indianapolis's undisputed leader. While our rival was primarily an adult music station, it had a large news department and was the one station everyone went to for information. We had a news block from 6 to 10 every morning and did sports in the afternoon, from 3 until whenever we had to sign off, which depended on what time sunset was, sometimes as early as 5:15 p.m. There's nothing like saying goodbye to your listeners in the middle of evening drive time. These days, WNTS is known for its original midday host, David Letterman. Dave was working as a weekend weatherman for the local ABC TV station, as well as hosting a farm show. My brother, then in college at Indiana University, insisted, "You have to hire Letterman." I knew of him. We are exactly the same age, 5 days apart, and he had gone to neighboring Broad Ripple High School. I had seen him on TV, and his weather reports were legendary. Once he announced that a significant snowstorm was approaching from the west, but don't worry about that because ICBMs are approaching from Russia. Another time he stated that it was 49 degrees in Kokomo and 49 degrees in Muncie, and they would play off that tie at a later date. And once he announced that hail the size of giant canned hams was approaching later that night. His reports are brilliant and incredibly offbeat, not something you would normally see in staid, conservative Indiana. I hired Dave immediately, and every day was an adventure. When he took the job, he told me, "In a year, I'm going to go to Hollywood to see if I can make it as a writer." It's hard to describe how funny he was or how little difference it made in our ratings. The experience taught me everything about reaching the audience available to you. Dave resonated with my age group. We found him brilliant every day. My friend, David Clapper, who had eventually found the athletic retailer Finish Line, was working at his dad's liquor store when Letterman debuted on WNTS. Clapper knew Letterman because they were a year apart at Broad Ripple High School. Clapper became part of a cadre of 25-year-olds, or thereabouts, who were addicted to Letterman. They listened every day and marveled at his brilliance. Unfortunately, 95% of the people who listen to AM talk radio are conservative 65-year-olds. To say that our listeners didn't get Dave was an understatement. Once upon returning from lunch, I got an angry phone call from an aging listener. "Sir, Dave Letterman is a communist." When I asked why he thought that, the listener replied, "I told him the communists were all over Carmel, a suburb of Indianapolis, and we needed to do something about it. And do you know what he said?" Of course I didn't, but I braced myself as he continued breathlessly. Letterman said to give Carmel to the communists. "The schools are overcrowded, parking is a mess, and the streets are always torn up. Let's let them keep Carmel and hold the line at Nora, a nearby suburb." I managed barely to hold back explosive laughter, but I mollified the shocked listener by assuring him that I would discuss the whole thing with Dave immediately. Dave had one elderly gentleman who would call regularly and spout largely insane, nonsensical things. And since AM stations at 1590 don't get a wide variety of callers, this guy was able to hog a great deal of airtime. After a few times, Dave decided that the only way to make the calls tolerable was to play sound effects in the background. Sometimes bombs would go off during the calls, sometimes mooing cows, but every time it was different and every time it was hilarious. Once Dave announced that the city of Indianapolis had sold the monument in the middle of Monument Circle to Guam in exchange for a 150-foot asparagus stalk. He noted with his typical deadpan delivery that the stalk would add greenery to the middle of downtown. Listeners actually called to express their disgust that the city would sell their beloved monument. Another time, Dave announced that the Indianapolis Motor Speedway had decided to accommodate all of the fans who wanted to watch the 500-mile race on the main straightaway and had decided to hold the race on Interstate 70 from Indianapolis to Kansas City, almost exactly 500 miles. People called in to ask how the tickets would be sold. The more nonsensical Dave's bits were, the more confused our listeners became. After a year, Dave moved to California, as he had promised, leaving behind a number of younger listeners who revered him, including everyone on our staff, and the great majority of our audience who were merely dazed and confused. To help Dave get started in Los Angeles, we paid him a small stipend to report from California. One of my favorite Letterman bits was that to save the Tournament of Roses parade from being canceled because of the skyrocketing cost of roses, the parade had made all of its floats from pork and pork byproducts. He noted that any savings were eliminated by medical costs necessitated by parade goers who had been sickened by the stench of rotting pork. On the other hand, Dave noted that the all-pork Minnie Mouse had looked absolutely lovely. Despite Letterman's hilarious commentary, it was clear from the beginning that making WNTS a success was going to be nearly impossible. A daytime signal on the worst position on the dial clearly left our station with both hands tied behind its back. WIBC and the other full-time stations had all of the resources and practically all of the listeners. I once joked that Fred Heckman, WIBC's longtime news director, had immense credibility in the market, and that if we put Walter Cronkite on WNTS, most Hoosiers would still think that Fred Heckman was a superior, more credible commentator. Although I was nearly manic in putting the station together, hiring an air staff, working on the programming elements, and writing sales presentations, something happened during my first few months that taught me some valuable lessons about myself and ultimately prepared me for the rest of my career. Probably sensing the impossibility of making WNTS successful, I went into a complete funk. It's the only time in my life that I could have been characterized as clinically depressed, and in retrospect, I'm sure that I was. After all, this was my first chance to manage something, to build success out of a project I had conceived, and I'm certain when I came to grips with the odds of success, I began to realize that it was destined to fail. I've seen fear of failure in myself and other people throughout the years, and it is absolutely paralyzing. I've since developed the ability to be my calmest when things are at their very worst, and it's an attribute that has served me very well during the absolute toughest times of my life, when faced with the death of loved ones or a significant setback in life or in business. It's hard to describe how it happened, but shortly after the start of WNT.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?